This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When frogs around the world are mysteriously dying, or when an infectious disease suddenly jumps species, spreading from bats to pigs to people, my guest Peter Daszak is the kind of detective you want on the case. He's not literally a detective. He's an expert in conservation medicine, a relatively new field that is investigating the links between environmental changes, emerging infectious diseases, and the diseases of highly endangered species. Daszak is the executive director of the Wildlife Trust's Consortium for Conservation Medicine, a collaborative enterprise which includes the Harvard Medical School, Tufts Veterinary School, and the National Wildlife Health Center. Daszak recently returned from the Galapagos Islands, where he was evaluating the risk of West Nile virus spreading into the area. I asked what problems the virus could cause if it did reach the islands.
Galapagos has some unique species of birds, darwins, finches, flightless cormorants. But West Nile virus is such a terrible disease. It goes into mammals, reptiles, and it kills them. So we've also got marine iguanas out there that are unique. We've got Galapagos sea lions. So there's potential that if this virus gets onto that community, and it's a group of animals that have never seen that virus before, there's no immunity there, then you could have some pretty serious consequences.
What can you do to stop it?
Well, what we tried to do was to look at the various ways that the virus could get into the islands. One obvious way is through hitching a ride with airplanes. And it's been done over many years to spray the insides of planes to try and kill these mosquitoes before they leave the plane. Not just in the passenger compartment, and this is one of the key things, that in the cargo hold, it might be actually more mosquitoes down there than in the passenger compartment. So spraying the cargo hold itself would be make a big difference. And it looks pretty clear that if you want to stop a crisis before it happens, you're going to have to do some measures that will try and do that and take the consequences of those measures as well.
Is the West Nile virus a sign that something in the ecosystem has gone out of control, or is it just the way the world works, that there are these viruses and some of them are mosquito-borne?
Well, I mean, it is definitely a sign that there's a problem out there. When a virus that has had millions of years of evolution in the old world, in Europe and Africa, suddenly appears in New York, of all places, for the first time in 1999, you've got to say, what's going on in the world to cause that to happen? And, of course, the reason for that is that right now we've got a very globalized world with a lot of travel from one place to another.
Right, and as you pointed out, the mosquitoes are traveling too, and they don't need to buy the airline ticket.
They get
a better deal. Now, you're also working on a virus that I believe is supposed to be similar to West Nile, called the Nipah virus?
Yeah, Nipah virus.
Nipah virus. What is this virus, and why should it matter to Americans?
Well, that's a very good question. Nipah is a village, a town in Malaysia, and the virus is named after that town, as so often happens with viruses. It first emerged in 1998-99, killing over 100 Malaysians who were associated with the pig industry, with hog farming and processing of pork. And it's a very strange virus. It actually lives in fruit bats, which are beautiful animals that exist in fruit bats, flying foxes. These are these large bats that live in the tropics and fly around in the tropical forest feeding on fruits. Absolutely beautiful animals. But it just so happens they carry these viruses that if they get into humans are incredibly lethal. Nipah virus killed 40% of the people that infected. So the reason that it matters to us here in our cozy studio in New York is that if one of these viruses emerges in a faraway country and then spreads globally, just like HIV/AIDS did, then we've got a risk that's going to affect us back home.
So what are you doing to monitor the spread of this virus?
Well, what we're trying to do is we're going back to the origin of the outbreak, and we're trying to say, look, let's reassess what really happened, what really caused this virus to emerge. We know it was in fruit bats, these flying foxes. We know that it then went into pigs in pig farms and killed a lot of pigs in Malaysia and then got into humans. But what was it that changed in the environment to suddenly cause this virus to move into pigs and humans for the first time? The virus has probably been there for many millions of years in fruit bats. What were the factors that allowed it to emerge?
So what do you think is the answer?
Well, we're working on a couple of hypotheses. One is that if you have huge numbers of pigs in very intensive conditions in areas where fruit bats live, that's a risk for a virus. And it's something about density of those pig populations that allows a virus to move into pigs and then build up enough numbers of viruses to then spread out into humans and cause an epidemic. The other idea is that maybe it's something that's changed about the fruit bats. Maybe what we're doing to the environment in Indonesia and Malaysia has driven fruit bats into different areas, caused them to change the migration patterns and sort of force them closer to pigs, where farmers also grow fruiting orchards, fruiting trees in orchards next to the pig farms.
So the Nipah virus spread from bats to pigs to people.
Yeah.
What were the symptoms in the bats? What were the symptoms in the pigs? And what were the symptoms in the people?
Well, in the bats, it looks like it doesn't really do that much. It's not really a disease that causes a big problem. They're the natural reservoir for the virus. It's a bit like herpes virus in humans. You get a cold sore and it stays with you for a while and you don't really notice it. In pigs, it was a very, very virulent infection. Lots of virus was produced. It goes into the lungs and they get this incredible cough, which was called the one-mile cough, because you could hear it a mile away. You could work out which farms were infected by hearing this horrible cough of these pigs in these farms. And, of course, that coughing then sprays the virus out into the atmosphere, and any human working in that area with pigs is likely to get infection. The infection in humans is even worse, and 40% of the people who were infected died. And the way that happened was usually a flu-like disease, a fever, and then respiratory infection, and then a brain infection, encephalitis. And eventually people would slip into a coma and die.
Hmm. Now, one of the issues that you have to work on, which relates to this issue of the Nipah virus, is why does a virus suddenly jump from one species to another, from a fruit bat to a pig,
yeah,
or from a pig to a person? Is there, like, what's your understanding of what that threshold is, what that point is, where suddenly a virus jumps from one species to another?
Well, it's very interesting. It's a sort of mixture of ecology, evolution, and basic virology. And if you look to the virology side of it, viruses behave in different ways. If you get a virus and put it into cell culture, quite often you can culture them in human cells, so we know it's possible that they could infect human cells. But it's only certain viruses that do this. And it seems to be that if you create the right ecological circumstances by putting humans in some way very close to wildlife that carry these viruses, you allow the ones that can move into humans to jump and then spread onwards. And a great example of that is HIV/AIDS, which, as we know, evolved from, certainly HIV-1, from a chimpanzee virus. And it's probably, almost certainly now, by butchering bush meat, chimpanzee meat, you allow the virus to directly infect humans, and then it ticks over and eventually becomes an outbreak.
And was the butchering of chimpanzee meat something new that had not happened before?
Well, that's a good question, because obviously, this has been going on for millions of years. You know, people feed on chimpanzees in Africa and have been doing for many millions of for thousands of years. What seems to have changed is the amount of bushmeat that's been taken out of the forest in the 50s and 60s, the ability to get fresh meat from remote regions back into towns and villages and butcher it there, and just the movement of populations, human populations, from one area to another. We know now that HIV-1 probably emerged a few times into humans, but it's only in the last time that it then became a global outbreak. And, of course, that's related to human population movement, centralization of working practices in Africa, and then globalization of air travel.
Now, we've been talking about how you have been tracking emerging diseases by going to different parts of the world and trying to figure out where the disease originated from, what environmental factors might have caused the disease or caused the virus to jump species. You helped solve a big mystery, which was why frogs were dying in unusually large numbers. Let's talk about the problem first. What was the problem and how was it discovered?
Well, it was interesting. It was a three or four, well, maybe three decades of people, conservationists mainly, ecologists, working in the wild and seeing amphibian populations disappearing in the wild and wondering what was the cause of this. And lots of different hypotheses put forward, that it was pollution, global climate change, increases in UV light, and still they may be part of the story. What happened was we started to look at, could it be the disease causing these declines? It was a new genus of fungus that lives on the skin of frogs. A very unusual organism. No one had described it before. It was new to science. We've now found out that it's been around for a long time. We've found it in histology sections through amphibians in museums. And it seems to somehow block maybe the way amphibians breathe through the skin or take in water through the skin, or maybe it secretes a toxin. But what we do know is it's very lethal to amphibians.
And do you have any idea how it got into the frog population?
That's what we're working on now. And we're very interested now in saying, we know what the disease is, we know that it kills amphibians, but why did it suddenly emerge? Why did it suddenly start killing off amphibians in America, you know, Latin America, North America, in Europe, in Australia? And what we've started to see is that there's a huge trade in amphibians for food, for the pet trade, for various other reasons, and that may well be involved in spreading this disease around the world.
How?
Well, because if you look into those trades, you find that the amphibians within them have got this disease, and they're then taken from one part of the world to another. And we've been especially interested in the restaurant trade in frogs, which is in America is mainly bullfrogs. Bullfrogs seem to be resistant in that you can infect them with the pathogen, but then they don't die, so they're good carriers of the pathogen. So if you move bullfrogs from one part of the world to another, and they've got this disease with them, they won't die, they'll just spread it. And that's what we're trying to work on now, to see how that's happening.
Some of your work is really specialized. You wrote a paper about, this sounds specialized to me anyways, you wrote a paper about intestinal sarcocytosis in the bull snake.
That's right.
What was that about?
You did some good research there. That's one of my favorites. I did that with a very good friend of mine from the Institute of Zoology in England called Andrew Cunningham, who's an amazing guy. He's a vet pathologist. So he used to be in charge of all pathology of everything that dies at London Zoo. And he used to call me up in the office and say, we've got another parasite infection. I'm originally a parasitologist. I worked on parasites. And he'd call up and say, we just, you know, what is this thing? Can you come and help us out? So we'd get together and go through the literature and try and work out what this thing was. In this case, it was a bull snake that was caught in America many years ago now and captured during winter. And normally, in the natural ecology of this parasite, is that it overwinters with snakes that hibernate. Because if you take a snake out of hibernation and stick it in a cage and heat it up, it's possible that the parasite then starts to proliferate, and that's what seems to have happened. So it was the first time we'd found a disease of this type causing death in an animal, which we thought was very important at the time, but of course it's pretty obscure.
Right. What were the implications of this?
Well, the implications are certainly for captive breeding of snakes, and you know, this snake wasn't endangered, but a lot of zoos do captive breeding where they're really struggling to find the perfect environment for the host, for the animal, but they forget about the parasites, and they forget that if you don't think about the pathogens that these animals are carrying, you'll either get disease problems or you'll have some sort of conservation problems. And a great example of that is when animals come into captivity and they're now extinct in the wild, and there are a few cases of this. Rothschild's Minor is a beautiful white bird from Bali, Indonesia. It's almost extinct in the wild, if not extinct by now. But there are good captive colonies in Europe and America, in zoos where there are very good captive breeding programs. But it looks like there are some parasites in that captive breeding program that have been introduced from other species. So now we've got a contaminated stock that we're going to try and reintroduce into the wild. And you've got to be very careful when you're tinkering with nature in this way, in these captive breeding programs, to try and maintain a balance between the animal and its natural parasites.
If it's dangerous to take endangered species, remove them from their environment, put them in a zoo, and then after they start populating, return them to their native environment, are there any other better solutions for trying to save endangered species?
Well, yeah, and I think a lot of zoos are being very progressive now, and they're looking, when they bring an animal into captivity, they don't sterilize it. They keep it in terms of getting rid of all the pathogens. They allow it to keep the parasites that it came in with, and I think that's what we've got to move towards. We're not just preserving an animal, we're preserving an animal and the 10, 20, maybe 100 pathogens or fleas or whatever they carry with them. They're unique species too. And we've already seen examples now where parasites have become extinct because of this process. And although they're parasites, they're not as commonly accepted as cute, cuddly, furry animals. They are species too, and I think we're mature enough as a society to say that they need to be conserved as well.
A lot of the emerging viruses that you study originate in rainforests and remote parts of the world, remote to us in America.
Yeah.
So you're going exactly to the kind of places where you can contact a rare disease or contact a disease in its emerging stage. What do you do to protect yourself when you're out investigating?
Well, I mean, certainly, our whole team is vaccinated with all the vaccines we can get for the countries that we go to. And, we're very serious about that. There are some pretty lethal diseases out there, or certainly serious diseases. But some things you can't protect for. And Nipah virus, for instance, there's no vaccine for Nipah virus. But we know about how it's transmitted, and we know the risks involved. And the risks are pretty low for that virus. It seems to have to go through pigs to get into humans. And there's no current outbreak. When you go to an outbreak area, that's different. And I think that there you are sometimes at risk of infection. And it's a risk that people take. And, you try and use all the protection you can get. For instance, when we're working with fruit bats, it's possible that you might be handling a bat that's actually got a virus. And it's very slim chance that you could pick the virus up directly from a bat. So we wear face protection and we handle them with gloves. And we're very careful. But, there's still a very slight risk.
If you could, play God for a second and control the world, what are some of the changes that you would most want to make in either our patterns of deforestation or agriculture, the food industry, changes that you think might help prevent the spread of emerging diseases?
Well, that's a really tough question, because when you really go back to the most basic common denominator, it's human population growth. And we've got to seriously address that. We've got to seriously address global poverty and inequity. But to prevent disease emergence, there are some very, very simple things we can do. I think we should be very serious about dealing with diseases before they emerge, instead of putting all our government funding into development of vaccines and drugs once they've already happened. I mean, what a essentially a waste of money for a government strategy, as well as a waste of life. Let's go back to those diseases that have already emerged and say, what are the common patterns there? Let's put in place some really serious surveillance on goods that we bring from one country to another and animals that we ship around the globe in increasingly huge numbers. And SARS is a great example of a very threatening virus that emerged from a trade in wildlife. I think we've got to seriously address the use of animals in those trades.
Now, one of your concerns is population growth, and you think population growth is in part responsible for emerging viruses and the spread of viruses. Some people would say that viruses are nature's way of keeping the population down.
Yeah.
Do you have that view of viruses, and is there a part of you that thinks that...
No, I think that's a very cruel argument to go down the line of. Viruses cause very painful death, and death in itself is a very painful thing. I think that the problem is that and this is population growth globally, is getting to the point where you wonder when we'll reach a threshold over which we start to see really serious problems in the environment. I think we're reaching that threshold. We've got global climate change now, pretty convincing evidence that that's happening due to our fossil fuel burning. And maybe it's not so much just population growth, but the way we exploit the environment, especially in developed countries, and the way we're continuing to do that, even in the face of this pretty obvious evidence that we've got serious environmental problems out there. And I think that the disease side of it is one other aspect of the environmental problems that we've caused. And I think that's what we need to grasp, that these emerging diseases are caused by us, by the way we travel around the world so much, by the trade that we do, by the deforestation that we do. Obviously, I'm not saying we've got to block these things. We don't have to instantly block trades and instantly deal with population growth, but they are part of the story, and we need to seriously address those issues.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us a bit about your work. Thank you.
My pleasure.